This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents Killing the Rising Sun: How America Vanquished World War II Japan by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard. Read for you by Robert Petkoff.
This book is dedicated to all World War II veterans. Freedom rings because of you. The Second World War officially began on September 1, 1939, with Germany's invasion of Poland. But that act of aggression took place 2 years after Japan sought to increase its sphere of influence by conquering the northeastern provinces of China, collectively known as Manchuria, a region the Japanese had renamed Manchukuo. The world's great powers were at a loss as how to stop them. Like Formosa, which Japan colonized in 1895, and Korea, colonized in 1910, Manchuria both enriched Dai Nippon and gave it enough power to compete with China and the Soviet Union as a leading power in Asia. But Japanese military leaders did not stop there. In fact, they could not. As an island nation, Japan is lacking in many natural resources. Chief among these are oil and rubber, two items vital to military mobility. The bulk of Japan's oil, steel, and iron throughout the 1930s was imported from the United States, while the plantations of British Malaya provided Japan's rubber supply. These products continued to flow into Japan even after Japan invaded China in the summer of 1937. But by that time, the world's powers had grown wary of Japan's increasing belligerence. The United States, the Soviet Union, and even Germany began providing military aid to the Chinese, but it did not matter. Fighting in the name of Hakko Ichiyu, a belief that all of Asia must be united under one emperor, Japanese troops quickly overwhelmed China, their superior training and aggressive tactics devastating the forces of Chiang Kai-shek. The Japanese did not limit their killing to Chinese soldiers. At 10 o'clock on 29 November 1937, we left to clean out the enemy in Shangshu, and at noon we entered the town, Japanese Army Doctor Hosaka Akira wrote in his 3x5-inch pocket journal. An order was received to kill the residents, and 80 of them, men and women of all ages, were shot to death. I hope this will be the last time I'll ever witness such a scene. The people were all gathered in one place. They were all praying, crying, and begging for help. I just couldn't bear watching such a pitiful spectacle. Soon the heavy machine guns opened fire, and the sight of those people screaming and falling to the ground is one I could not face, even if I had had the heart of a monster. By December 1937, the Japanese had captured the capital city of Nanking. Prior to that, the battle for Shanghai during the autumn months of 1937 had cost the Japanese 92,000 casualties. More than 200,000 Chinese also lost their lives. The Imperial Japanese Army immediately sought revenge for their Shanghai dead, inflicting horrifying atrocities on the civilian population. The Japanese began their killing spree with the execution of 90,000 captured Chinese soldiers. In a pattern of behavior that displayed Japan's contempt for the Geneva Conventions, which protect prisoners of war from torture, assault, or execution, these men were stabbed to death, hung by their tongues, attacked by dogs, set ablaze, machine-gunned, buried alive, and beheaded. Footnote: the first Geneva Convention of 1864 was signed by Japan in 1886. Subsequent agreements were produced in 1906 and 1929. Japan signed the 1929 treaty and verbally agreed to adhere to the terms of the 1906 treaty. The emperor obviously did not live up to his word. End footnote. Next, civilians in the city were shot at random, sometimes being forced to dig their own graves beforehand. Japanese soldiers held horrifying killing contests in which they strived to see who could behead the most Chinese. Those barbarous acts were a mere prelude to what became of the women of Nanking, an estimated 80,000 of whom were systematically raped. Japanese soldiers would recount for years to come how much they enjoyed these acts, often perpetrated against children and grandmothers. Teams of Japanese soldiers developed a routine for each assault. The group would hold a victim down while one man checked to ensure that the woman did not have a sexually transmitted disease. Then the soldiers would cast lots to see who would go first. Victims were often bayoneted after the last man finished. If a woman was pregnant at the time, the baby might be cut from her womb with a knife. If the soldiers who fought in the name of Emperor Hirohito came upon a family, it was common for them to force fathers to rape their daughters, brothers to rape their sisters, and even sons to rape their mothers. Those females who survived these horrors often went on to become comfort women for the Japanese soldiers who would occupy China until 1945. These sexual slaves had no choice but to endure many more years of rape. In all, the Japanese systematically defiled and murdered half of Nanking's 600,000 citizens. Their behavior was hardly a secret. The people of Japan thrilled to news that the Chinese were being savagely tyrannized. In Tokyo, the Japan Advertiser ran a daily tally of the dead in a decapitation contest between two prominent Japanese soldiers. Back in Washington, D.C., President Roosevelt and Congress all but ignored the Japanese atrocities. When the New York Times printed a front-page story about the brutality in Nanking, the article was treated with skepticism. Some Americans considered the rape of Nanking too gruesome to be true, and the American leadership stayed silent. When the Japanese continued their military expansion with the invasion of French Indochina in 1940, President Roosevelt embargoed the sale of all oil to Japan. As an ally of America, Great Britain soon followed suit. On July 26, 1941, FDR went a step further and froze all Japanese assets in the United States. On the surface, FDR's action was a simple attempt to stop Japanese aggression in Asia. Yet it sent shockwaves through the Japanese military. Without oil, their tanks and ships would be useless. Japan's navy had a 6-month reserve of fuel, but no more. Japan's top generals began making plans to find new sources of oil. Japan began to see itself as a victim of American aggression. Unfortunately, rather than discouraging war in the Pacific, Roosevelt's embargo made it more likely. As tensions rose between Japan and the United States, the Japanese military came up with a most audacious plan. It would invade every nation, island, and colony that could offer it natural resources. In a matter of days, Japanese forces would spill onto the beaches of the Philippines, Singapore, the Dutch East Indies, British Malaya, Sarawak, and British and Dutch Borneo, and into the jungles of Burma. Prisoners taken along the way would be put to work as slave labor, building infrastructure, harvesting on plantations, and digging in the mines. The plan was horrifying but brilliant. While Japanese aggression was not unexpected, the scope of this outrageous design would catch the rest of the world flat-footed. Japanese generals hoped the element of surprise would guarantee total victory. The peace-loving prime minister at the time, Fumimaro Konoha, hoped for a diplomatic breakthrough with the United States, but by October 1941 it was quite clear this would not come to pass. Konoha then resigned, not having the stomach for a brutal world war. His replacement was Hideki Tojo, a short, arrogant army general. Nicknamed Razor for his brusque demeanor and attention to detail, 56-year-old Tojo distinguished himself on the field of battle in the early days of the war in China. He is descended from Japan's venerated samurai warrior class. Selected over others who thought him too militaristic, Tojo was hand-picked by Emperor Hirohito to serve as the new prime minister, making him the second most powerful man in Japan. His pro-war stance made it very clear how he would wield that strength. "We have finally committed to war," a high-level Japanese official will write in his journal shortly after Tojo's selection. "And now we must do all we can to launch it powerfully." For those who opposed his jingoistic attitude, Tojo had a simple argument. "Sometimes it is necessary to shut one's eyes and take the plunge." Tojo had to manage two key elements if the plunge was to succeed. The first was Hirohito himself. For months, the emperor wavered on whether or not to expand Japan's war with China to include a continuation of its conquest of Asia and vital Pacific island nations within its sphere of influence. Of course, His Majesty is a pacifist, and there is no doubt he wished to avoid war. Former Prime Minister Konawa will write on the day he resigns from office in October 1941, knowing that his attempts to prevent war will be in vain. "When I told him that to initiate war is a mistake, he agreed. Gradually, he began to lean toward war." Through Tojo's careful ministrations, Hirohito became more hawkish. At first, the emperor was reluctant to give his final blessing to the attack plans. But on November 2, 1941, just 2 weeks after Tojo took office, his persuasion won the day. Hirohito agreed that it was time to complete the Japanese mission of conquest, which left one last stumbling block to Japanese victory in what the nation will come to call the Greater East Asia War, the United States Navy. No other force was capable of stopping Japan's mighty fleet as it sailed forth through the Pacific, sending aloft its planes and delivering waves of soldiers to foreign beaches. As long as the U.S. Navy loomed as a threat, Tojo could never be completely assured of Japanese success. So in addition to overseeing the invasion plans that would place tiny Japan in a position of dominance no other Asian nation had ever known, Tojo also made Emperor Hirohito aware of plans to destroy America's Pacific Fleet. All of it. For years, the Japanese military had known its primary adversary might eventually be the United States. Although himself opposed to embroiling Japan in a dangerous and costly war, Commander-in-Chief of Japan's combined fleet, Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto, had long been in favor of an aerial bombardment that would destroy the "dagger being pointed at our throats," as he referred to the U.S. fleet. The attack would happen on a Sunday morning, a time when most sailors would be sleeping in after a night on the town. Waves of carrier-launched Japanese dive bombers would drop from the skies, unloading torpedoes and bombs that would sink destroyers and demolish airplanes, forever ending America's naval presence in the Pacific. Yamamoto knew just where to find these ships. They were anchored bow to stern and side by side at a balmy tropical naval base in Hawaii, a place known as Pearl Harbor. Northfield, Tinian, Mariana Islands, August 6, 1945, 0130 hours. The bringer of death sits in the front seat of a 6x6 army truck. Approaching the B-29 he personally selected for this mission, Colonel Paul Tibbetts wears a one-piece tan flight suit and a billed cap. In preparation for the coming 12-hour mission, he carries cigars, cigarettes, loose tobacco, and a pipe. Should his plane be shot down, Tibbetts also has a handgun. And if capture becomes a possibility, he also carries 12 cyanide pills, one for each member of his crew. Better to end their lives than be tortured into giving away A-bomb secrets. Tibbetts knew there would be commotion about tonight's mission, but he never expected the sight before him. Floodlights turn the black tropical night into day. Flashbulbs pop as Tibbetts and his crew arrive at the flight line. Scientists and technicians flit around the bomber, fussing over last-minute details. Inside the forward bomb bay, safely concealed from view, is the bulbous 8,900-pound shape of Little Boy, soon to be dropped from a height of 5 miles onto Hiroshima. The target point is the concrete and steel Aioi Bridge, whose T-shape is easily visible from the air. Just hours ago, the B-29 with the number 82 painted on the rear of the fuselage finally got a nickname. Tibbetts wrote the words on a scrap of paper and handed it to a sign painter in mid-afternoon. In the past, he has favored aggressive names such as Butcher Shop and Red Gremlin for his aircraft, but the plane he will fly tonight will hold a special place in history, so he indulges in a rare display of sentiment. By 4 p.m., the aircraft was formally christened Enola Gay in honor of Tibbetts' 54-year-old mother. Years ago, when the colonel angered his father by quitting his job as a physician's assistant at a venereal disease clinic to pursue a flying career, it was Enola Gay who calmed the waters. "If you want to go kill yourself," his father had said angrily, "I don't give a damn." To which the former Enola Gay haggard added quietly, "Paul, if you want to go fly airplanes, you're going to be all right." Now, with the black block letter painting of Enola Gay's name on the silver fuselage, she and her son will forever be linked in history. Footnote: the seldom used name Enola is the word alone spelled in reverse. It is believed that Enola Gay Tibbetts' parents were inspired to give her the name by the 1867 Laura Preston novel In Bonds, in which Enola is the name of a special place to a main character. When Enola Gay Tibbetts later learned that her name was painted on the aircraft that dropped the Hiroshima bomb, her face displayed no visible emotion. However, her stomach would often jiggle when something made her happy. "You should have seen the old gal's belly jiggle on that one," Tibbetts' father told his son of the moment it was announced on the radio. End footnote. "There stood the Enola Gay," Tibbetts will later write, "bathed in floodlights like the star of a Hollywood movie. Motion picture cameras were set up and still photographers were standing by with their equipment. Any Japanese lurking in the surrounding hills, and there were still some who had escaped capture, had to know that something very special was going on." Soon, the thrum of the 2,200-horsepower B-29 Wright Cyclone engines fills the air as the advanced weather planes Jabot 3, Full House, and Straight Flush lumber down the 8,500-foot east-west runway Able, which has been nicknamed the Hirohito Highway. One by one, the planes take off and ascend into the night for the 12-hour round-trip flight to the Empire. The time is 1:37 a.m. Colonel Paul Tibbetts and Enola Gay are set to take off in 1 hour. Preparation has been intense. At 2 p.m., Little Boy was pulled by tractor to a special loading pit. Due to its size, it cannot fit beneath the B-29's fuselage for loading like normal bombs. Instead, a concrete-lined pit has been dug into the earth. At 2:15, Enola Gay was backed over the pit before the atomic weapon was loaded into the bomb bay with a hydraulic lift. Captain Deke Parsons entered the bay at 3:30 to practice the 11 steps necessary to arm the bomb mid-flight, which he has never done before. Just this morning, 4 B-29s rolling out for standard bombing missions crashed on takeoff, detonating all their explosives. Parsons is openly fearful that a similar crash of Enola Gay will wipe Tinian off the map. By 5:30, with the words Enola Gay painted in block letters just beneath the cockpit, the B-29 was ready for pre-flight testing, which went off without incident. At 8 p.m., Colonel Tibbetts conducted a final briefing. In addition to flight routes, altitudes, and departure times, he pinpointed the location of rescue ships and submarines that would be in the area in case a plane had to ditch in the ocean. This information was particularly vital because the U.S. Navy had just issued a warning for all ships to stay at least 50 miles away from Hiroshima. This reduced the potential number of rescue vessels, meaning that only a pinpoint water landing would save Tibbetts and his crew in an emergency. Catholic Mass was prayed at 10 p.m. A Protestant service followed immediately at 10:30. Almost every man attended one or the other. Tibbetts, a man whose only faith is in the physics of aviation, attended neither. The men are loose but pensive, trained professionals who have flown scores of combat missions. However, during the final pre-flight midnight meal of sausage, blueberry pancakes, and real eggs in the mess hall, affectionately nicknamed the Dog Patch Inn, Tibbetts was nervous, though trying not to show it. He ate little, preferring to drink black coffee and smoke his pipe. His time had almost come. 300 miles southwest of Tinian, the USS Oneida, a fast attack transport, has just arrived in the bustling anchorage at Ulithi, an island atoll 400 miles northeast of Palau. She dropped anchor at 1500 hours on August 5th, the same time Little Boy was being loaded into Enola Gay's bomb bay. Oneida is carrying a cargo of fresh Army soldiers traveling from Pearl Harbor to Okinawa, where they will train for the invasion of Japan. The Oneida is a new ship, commissioned just last December. She is 455 feet long and 62 feet wide at the beam, with a top speed of 17.7 knots. In her short time afloat, she has taken a nearly full tour of the Pacific, maintaining almost non-stop motion, carrying men and cargo in and out of combat zones. Since leaving San Francisco on January 30th, Oneida has visited 19 ports or anchorages. Footnote. The Oneida were an Iroquois tribe living in upstate New York who gave their name to counties in New York, Wisconsin, and Idaho, as well as to the ship. The USS Oneida from World War II was actually the third ship bearing that moniker, the first being a brig of war in the War of 1812. The second was a storied sloop of war that served gallantly in the American Civil War from 1862 to 1865 and sank off the coast of Yokohama, Japan in 1870 when she collided with a British steamer. Seven crew members of the ship's second incarnation were awarded the Medal of Honor for their courageous actions. End footnote. A young ensign from Brooklyn, New York is among the ship's 56-man officer corps. He is 21 and quick-witted, the son of a New York City policeman. In his 9-month stint aboard Oneida, the recent graduate of the Navy's V-12 Navy College training program at the College of the Holy Cross has seen action off the coast of Okinawa, witnessed defeated Japanese soldiers up close when the Oneida ferried 1,050 prisoners of war to Pearl Harbor last month, and experienced all manner of weather, most of all rain, heat, and tropical humidity. In 1 month's time, the ensign will even endure a typhoon aboard Oneida. As with so many soldiers and sailors, the young officer does not know what lies ahead for him. There are, of course, rumors of a massive American invasion of the Japanese mainland. All American military personnel know that would lead to catastrophic casualties on both sides. The ensign will do his duty, whatever happens, but he would like to make it home alive. There is a young woman waiting for him. A methodical man, Colonel Tibbetts makes one last walk around Enola Gay, scrutinizing her for signs of trouble. With 7,000 gallons of fuel and a 4-ton bomb, she is almost 7 tons overweight, so even the slightest malfunction could be deadly. I made sure there were no open pieces of cowling, no pitot covers left hanging, and that the tires were inflated and in good condition. I also checked the pavement for telltale evidence of hydraulic leaks and looked into the bottom of the engine cowlings with a flashlight to be sure there was no excessive oil drip. Tibbetts enters the cockpit through a ladder at the aft end of the nose gear. The other 11 members of the crew also get on the plane, find their seats, and arrange themselves for the long flight. Tibbetts sits in the seat on the left, reserved for the aircraft commander. Co-pilot Bob Lewis takes the right seat. There is tension between the two men, for Enola Gay was Lewis's aircraft before Tibbetts chose to change the name and fly it on this mission. Outside, spectators wait patiently on the tarmac for Enola Gay to take flight. Tibbetts is in no hurry, unworried about his audience or the bruised feelings of Captain Lewis as he runs through yet another pre-flight check of instruments and systems. Once all four engines are running, Tibbetts does a final check of the oil pressure, fuel pressure, and RPM gauges. The thrum of the propellers causes Enola Gay to shake. Only when she takes flight will the vibration cease. The entire checkout and starting procedure required about 35 minutes, and it was now 2:30, Tibbetts will remember. Waving to the crowd of almost 100 who were standing by, I gunned the engines and began our taxi. Destination? Hiroshima. 21. Hiroshima, Japan, August 6, 1945, 7:10 a.m. The humid air is filled with warning. Air raid sirens again awaken the citizens of Hiroshima. The morning has dawned warm and clear with just a few wispy clouds in the sky. A single American B-29 has been seen flying toward the city, causing the alert to sound and disrupting the start of the business day, a time for cooking the morning meal and boarding the streetcar to work. Air raid warnings are now a constant nuisance, but at this late point in the war, it seems unlikely the Americans will finally bomb the city. So while some residents dutifully flee into bomb shelters, others go about their day. In the huge harbor, shrimp fishermen tend to their nets as their ancestors have done for centuries. They ignore the air raid warnings as they have nowhere to flee. In the southern section of town, near the port, the Ujina fire station is relatively calm, and fireman Yosaku Mikami looks at the clock. He is less than 60 minutes away from the end of his 24-hour shift, but any bombing will cause fires, meaning Yosaku's services will be needed immediately. Despite the evacuation of his family yesterday and the empty house that awaits him, Yosaku is eager to get home. He patiently waits for the sound of the all-clear siren, and at 7:32 he hears it. The danger has passed. Or so it seems. On the other side of town, 16-year-old Akira Onogi is executing his plan to take the day off from work at the Mitsubishi shipbuilding plant. A studious boy, Akira is angry that he can no longer attend school due to the war, but he now lies content on the floor of his parents' home reading a book. Akira is looking forward to a day of leisure. He has no plans at all. The all-clear siren alerts the people who took shelter at the Hachobori streetcar station that they can now emerge. 20-year-old Akiko Takakura is a cautious young woman, but she now resumes her journey to the Gaibi Bank, where she does secretarial work. The bank, with its stone walls and armored window coverings that let in almost no light, is less than a half mile from the T-shaped Aioi Bridge spanning the Ota River. What will soon be ground zero. 3 days ago, the clock tower at Hiroshima University stopped working at precisely 8:15. The city lacks the spare parts and material to fix it, so the great clock looking down on all of Hiroshima remains frozen in time. As Akiko enters the lobby of her workplace, she notices that the bank clock in the lobby is just a few moments away from striking 8:15. It is an omen Akiko will never forget. Enola Gay flies over Japan at an altitude of 30,700 feet. The overloaded bomber can climb no higher. Weather plane Straight Flush, which caused the air raid sirens to sound in Hiroshima this morning, has reported that the weather is fine for visual bombing. With that message, the fate of the city is sealed. "It's Hiroshima," Colonel Paul Tibbetts barks into Enola Gay's intercom. 6 hours ago, shortly after taking off from Tinian, Captain Deke Parsons and his assistant, Lieutenant Morris Jepson, wriggled through the small pressurized opening separating the bomb bay from the rest of the aircraft. Little Boy almost entirely fills the cavernous space. The ugly bomb is bulbous, with four square tail fins to guide its descent, a design predicated upon performance instead of appearance. A single shackle holds Little Boy in place. Braces keep the bomb from swaying side to side. Standing on a small catwalk, Parsons positions himself at the rear of the device. He needs light to see what he is doing, so Jepson, a physicist educated at Harvard, Yale, and MIT, provides it. The captain works quickly, running through an 11-step checklist that arms Little Boy. Opening a small panel, he inserts four silk packages of cordite powder. This smokeless propellant will detonate the uranium bullet at one end of the bomb's inner cannon barrel. The small chunk of enriched U-235 will race down the barrel and collide with a separate sphere of uranium known as the nucleus at the opposite end. Within 1/1,000,000,000th of a second of the bullet striking the nucleus, a picosecond in technical terms, the splitting of one atom into two smaller atoms will begin the process of nuclear fission. The explosion will follow immediately, releasing deadly heat and radioactive gamma rays. As Parsons arms Little Boy, the sharp, machined edges of the rear panel cut his fingertips. Undaunted, he finishes the job in 25 minutes. His final act is to insert 3 green dummy plugs between Little Boy's battery and its firing mechanism. Little Boy is armed but fragile. Anything that ignites the cordite charges will cause it to explode, killing all the men on Enola Gay. Thus, the green plugs placed between the electrical connections. As long as those plugs are secure, Little Boy will not detonate. Just before they enter Japanese airspace, Deke Parsons sends Morris Jepson back into the bomb bay one last time. The blonde lieutenant replaces the green plugs with 3 red arming plugs, thus establishing an electrical circuit between the battery and the bomb. Little Boy is now alive. 1 hour later, Enola Gay bombardier Thomas Farabee announces, pointing straight out the front bubble window of the aircraft, "I've got the bridge." The Aioi Bridge was chosen as Little Boy's aiming point because of its location in the center of Hiroshima and its unique T-shaped appearance, visible from the air. Looking down, Colonel Tibbetts can see the white buildings of downtown Hiroshima. He can actually see a mass of movement that looks like people walking to work. "My eyes were fixed on the center of the city, which shimmered in the early morning light," he will later remember. Enola Gay flies the last miles to Hiroshima uncontested. No enemy planes or anti-aircraft fire greet the Americans. Japanese air defense officials, having already sounded 3 air raid warnings during the night, choose to ignore the B-29's approach, thinking it to be on a simple reconnaissance mission. With 90 seconds to go, bombardier Thomas Farabee positions his left eye over the Norden bombsite's viewfinder. If he does his job properly, allowing for Enola Gay's airspeed of 333 miles per hour and the slight amount of wind that will cause the bomb to drift, Little Boy should fall to the ground with pinpoint accuracy. "One minute out," Tibbetts announces, breaking radio silence. Farabee flicks a switch that sends a sharp tone into the headphones of the Enola Gay crew and those of the men in the 2 scientific planes following behind, reminding them of what is to come. They are to put specially darkened goggles over their eyes to protect their vision. All 3 planes have been ordered to flee the vicinity as soon as possible to avoid the aftershock of the atomic explosion. 30 seconds, says Tibbetts. 20. The bomb bay doors open at precisely 8:15 a.m., the exact moment at which the Hiroshima University clock froze 3 days ago. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. At 8:15:17 a.m., Little Boy is set loose from its shackle. Instantly, Enola Gay lurches upward, finally rid of the 4 extra tons beneath her nose. Tibbetts wrestles her sharply to the right, almost standing her on a wing as he turns away from Hiroshima. He has less than 50 seconds to distance himself from the blast. If he fails to cover enough ground, Enola Gay will be destroyed by shockwaves. Despite the 60-degree bank, a move more suited to a lithe fighter aircraft than a massive bomber, bombardier Farabee keeps his left eye affixed to his Norden bombsite, allowing him to watch Little Boy plummet to Earth. The bomb wobbles after first being dropped, but the 4 stabilizing fins soon force the nose down, propelling it toward the heart of Hiroshima. Farabee is transfixed, knowing that he is witnessing history. 10 seconds pass. 20. 30. Almost too late, he remembers that the explosion's brightness will blind anyone who stares at it. Just in time, Farabee unglues his eye from the bombsite and turns away from Little Boy's descent. 43 seconds after its release at an altitude of 1,890 feet over the Aioi Bridge in downtown Hiroshima, Little Boy's radar proximity fuse detonates. Within the bomb's inner cannon, the 4 cordite charges explode, sending the uranium bullet hurtling the length of the barrel, where it collides with the second mass of U-235. The chain reaction is instantaneous. In the blast that follows, a fireball spreads out over the target zone. it travels at 100 times the speed of sound, rendering it silent. 1 millionth of a second later, the people of Hiroshima begin to incinerate. Almost 12 miles away, the shockwave slams into the escaping Enola Gay so hard that Tibbetts shouts, "Flak!" thinking the plane has been hit by ground fire. He feels a strange tingling sensation in his mouth, the result of his fillings interacting with the radioactive elements now billowing thousands of feet into the air. But Enola Gay is safe. All 12 men on board are alive. In 6 hours, they will celebrate with whiskey and lemonade and spend the night far from the hell they have just created. Little Boy explodes 300 yards from its primary target. The temperature inside the bomb at the moment of nuclear fission is more than 1,000,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which sends out a white flash of light 10 times the brightness of the sun. Millionths of a second later, the heat on the ground directly below the bomb spikes to 6,000 degrees, bringing with it deadly radioactive gamma rays. A 35-year-old widow, Mrs. Aoyama, has sent her young son off to his mandatory work detail early. Per her daily routine, she is outdoors, working in the vegetable garden she shares with monks from a nearby Buddhist temple. The vegetable garden is located directly beneath the exploding Little Boy, the precise spot on the earth that will be known as the hypocenter. Mrs. Aoyama is vaporized. Death comes so quickly that her nerve endings do not have time to react to pain, nor even acknowledge the presence of the light and heat liquefying her bones and boiling her brain at a temperature 5 times greater than that of boiling water. Thousands of men, women, and children within a half-mile radius of Mrs. Aoyama are simultaneously reduced to lumps of charcoal, their internal organs evaporating inside their charred corpses. Downtown Hiroshima is instantly covered in smoking black piles that were once human bodies. One woman standing in front of the Hiroshima Central Broadcasting Station tries to flee, only to be carbonized in a running position, her baby pressed tightly to her body. But that is just the beginning. 3 milliseconds later, the sky erupts into a fireball 300 yards wide as the surrounding air ignites, liquefying everyone in its proximity. Then comes the blast, as the explosion rockets outward with the force of 20,000 tons of TNT, followed immediately by a billowing mushroom cloud that rises more than 50,000 feet into the air, sucking up dust, dirt, and bodily gases from the vaporized remains of those killed at the hypocenter. Within seconds, 70,000 people are dead. Almost every person and building within a 1 mile radius of the hypocenter has vanished. Pets, birds, rats, ants, cockroaches, gone. Homes, fishing boats, telephone poles, the centuries-old Hiroshima castle, all disappeared. Day turns into night as the mushroom cloud blots out the sun. Beyond the 1 mile radius of the hypocenter, some have survived, though at a horrible cost. Flash burns blind all those unfortunate to be caught looking in the direction of the blast, while the intense heat maims and disfigures thousands, many of whom live miles away. One group of Japanese soldiers is burned so badly that their faces literally melt away. It is impossible to distinguish the back of their heads from the front. No one is spared the suffering. A group of students from the Hiroshima Girls Business School are covered with blisters the size of balls on their backs, their faces, their shoulders, and their arms. The blisters were starting to burst open, and their skin hung down like rugs. Japanese photojournalist Yoshito Matsushige will remember. The heat incinerates the clothes of many victims, such as the 15 passengers on a streetcar on the outskirts of the city. They all now lie dead in a naked pile. Because dark colors absorb heat while light colors reflect it, some of the unclothed women have burns in the shape of flowers on their bodies as a result of the designs on the kimonos they were wearing at the time of their death. If the designers of Little Boy imagined a single bomb blast would inflict instant death on thousands, they were correct. The truth is that it does not take much imagination to foresee puncture wounds caused by shards of exploded glass and wood hurtling through the air. The atomic blast wave travels at 2 miles per second, knocking flat anything in its path. Then there is the horror of radiation. Radioactive particles of dust that will slowly kill residents of Hiroshima for months and years to come. But there is even more. Thousands of Japanese die from fire and water. The flames come first, individual blazes that begin at the instant little boy explodes. Within 5 minutes, almost every structure within a 2-mile radius of the blast is ablaze, a raging firestorm that propels a powerful flaming wind. Soon that wind reaches hurricane strength, reducing much of Hiroshima to cinders. Many residents are now buried in the rubble of their collapsed homes. Trapped beneath thick wooden beams and tons of ceramic roof tiling, they frantically plea for rescue as the fires burn closer. Their screams echo throughout the streets of Hiroshima. To escape the firestorm or to cool the burns covering their bodies, many Japanese leap into the city's firefighting cisterns. But what happens next is yet another cruel twist of fate. The explosion has superheated the water, and everyone immersing himself or herself in it immediately boils to death. Others try to escape the flames by diving into one of the 7 rivers that flow through Hiroshima, only to find the water clogged with dead bodies. Many are actually pushed into the water by the enormous crowds trying to flee the firestorm. Once they are caught in the current, the number of corpses makes it impossible to swim. I saw a few live people still in the water, knocking against the dead as they floated down the river, one eyewitness will later recall. There must have been hundreds and thousands who fled to the river to escape the fire and then drowned. Hiroshima is chaos. Some confused citizens maintain almost total silence as they endure the horrors of Little Boy. Many wander the streets in a daze, arms held away from their bodies to prevent them rubbing against their burns, staring at the carbon lumps on the street, picking their way through the debris and absorbing the surreal nature of what has happened. Others, their homes destroyed, join the long line of Hiroshima's citizens frantically retreating to the safety of the countryside. Just seconds after Little Boy's detonation, the Japan Broadcasting Corporation in Tokyo notices that their Hiroshima station is off the air. The control operator gets on the phone to see if he can help fix the problem, but gets no response. Soon it becomes clear that Hiroshima's train station, telegraph operators, and military garrison have also severed communications. Fearing an American bombing, the headquarters of the Japanese military, the General Staff Office, dispatches a young officer from Tokyo to investigate. His orders are to fly to Hiroshima immediately and ascertain whether or not the city has been the target of an American attack. The next day, the chilling results of what the young officer saw from the air are reported on Japanese radio. Practically all living things, human and animal, were literally seared to death. Those who survived the bombing of Hiroshima will forever be known in Japan as the Hibakusa, the explosion-affected people. The difference between survival and death is often luck. Standing inside a concrete building that blocks the shockwaves, or having the good fortune of not being pinned beneath a large beam when a house collapses. The atomic bomb does not discriminate, Hiroshima weatherman Isao Kita will remember. The atomic bomb kills everyone from little babies to old people. And it's not an easy death. It's a very cruel and very painful way to die. Among the Hibakusa is fireman Yosaku Mikami, who was spared death on his way home because his streetcar was shielded from the blast by a tunnel. The car passed through Miyukibashi and was approaching the train office when I saw the blue flash from the window. At the same time, smoke filled the car, which prevented me even from seeing the person standing directly in front of me. Yosaku returns to the fire station, where he joins his colleague on the fire truck. They are confronted by utter chaos and unimaginable horror as they come upon scores of victims swearing, screaming, shouting, asking for help. Yosaku and his fellow firefighters immediately go to work, hoping to find a hospital where they might take the worst of the victims. We tried to open the eyes of the injured, and we found out they were still alive. We tried to carry them by their arms and legs and to place them onto the fire truck, but this was difficult because their skin was peeled off as we tried to move them. But they never complained they felt pain, even when their skin was peeling off. Yosaku and the other firemen traveled through the city, tending to the wounded and visiting other fire stations to determine the fate of their brother firefighters. They find many still alive, combating the blazes, but they also come upon scenes of horrifying death. At one station, Yosaku finds a fireman scorched to death inside his truck. He looked as if he was about to start the fire engine to fight the fire. Stunned by the shockwaves, 16-year-old Akira Onogi is thrown through the air and knocked unconscious. When Akira comes to, he walks outside to find his neighbor standing naked in the rubble of his ruined home, too consumed with searching for lost family members to care about the flaps of burned flesh hanging off his own body. I talked to him, but he was too exhausted to give me a reply. He was looking for his family desperately, Akira will long remember. We found this small girl crying, and she asked us to help her mother, trapped by a fallen beam on top of the lower half of her body. Akira and a group of onlookers work together to lift the crushing section of wood, but their efforts are in vain. Finally, a fire broke out, endangering us, so we had no choice but to leave her. She was conscious, and we deeply bowed to her with clasped hands to apologize to her, and then we left. For the next 10 years, sparks given off by electric streetcars will startle Akira, reminding him of the A-bomb's instantaneous flash, the Pikadon, or spark and bang, as it is so often called by survivors. And he will never sit by a window, having seen far too many corpses pierced by exploding panes of glass. But the most vivid moment, the one that will stay with Akira the rest of his life, is the memory of the daughter and her doomed mother. 30 years after the atomic bomb blast, Akira will immortalize his sorrow on canvas, painting the scene with unbridled emotion. He places himself in the painting's bottom right-hand corner, hands pressed together in remorse, as the sobbing little girl begs him to save her mother's life. Footnote: Akira's painting will become one of the iconic images of the Hiroshima bombing, frequently to be seen on display at the Hiroshima Peace Memorial Museum. End footnote. Gaibi Bank employee Akiko Takakura is also among those spared. She stepped into work just moments before her workplace exploded at 8:15, stopping the bank's clock at that precise time. "When I was doing my morning routine, dusting the desks and things like that, the A-bomb was dropped. All I remember was that I saw something flash suddenly." Though the bank is just 300 yards from the center of the bomb blast, its stone walls and armored window coverings provide perfect protection. Just on the other side of those walls, on the steps leading into the bank, Akiko would have been instantly burned into a carbon lump. Momentarily knocked unconscious from the blast, Akiko wakes up a short time later and staggers out into the street to a scene of profound horror. "Many people on the street were killed almost instantly. The fingertips of those dead bodies caught fire, and the fire gradually spread over their entire bodies from their fingers. A light gray liquid dripped down their hands, scorching their fingers. I was so shocked to know that fingers and bodies could be burned and deformed like that." Akiko wanders through the city in a daze, her progress slowed by the countless dead bodies she carefully steps over. She makes her way to the former military garrison, where bare-chested soldiers were performing their morning calisthenics just an hour ago. "At the drill ground, the burnt field was strewn with what must have been dead soldiers." She lies down on the ground to rest. "I don't know how much time passed, but at dusk I suddenly vomited what must have been the remnants of my breakfast. I vomited bloody phlegm twice. I knew then that I too would die in that place." Despite 102 cuts on her back from flying glass and debris, along with 2 serious burns and many bruises, Akiko finds the will to go on. "I'm going to live. I've got to live," she tells herself. A half century from now, determined that a new generation of Japanese must never forget the horror she is experiencing today, Akiko will write the poem, "To Children Who Don't Know the Atomic Bomb," describing that morning in graphic detail and ending with the following unforgettable image. "One woman walking on the road died, and then her fingers burned, a blue flame shortening them like candles." Footnote: Eyewitness Testimonies, Appeals from the A-Bomb Survivors, Hiroshima Peace Culture Foundation. Decades after the blast, at the age of 45, Akiko was diagnosed with a tumor on her spine, which was successfully removed. In 2012, at the age of 86, she was diagnosed with myelodysplastic syndrome, MDS, a blood anomaly that is often a precursor to leukemia. Both of these conditions are common in survivors of the atomic bomb. At the age of 89, Akiko currently carries out the duties of the head priest's wife at the Hunji Temple in the Asakita Ward of Hiroshima. End of footnote. The time in Tokyo is 7:50 p.m. It has been 11 hours and 35 minutes since Little Boy was dropped on Hiroshima. Many in the Japanese high command believe that the bomb was atomic, but the generals have withheld this news from their emperor all afternoon. It is dusk, and Hirohito takes advantage of the warm August night to stroll the gardens of the Imperial Palace, completely unaware of what has happened in Hiroshima. Suddenly, an aide from the Imperial Japanese Army approaches, which can only mean bad news. Such an intrusion on the Emperor's solitude is unheard of except in a time of tragedy. In somber tones, the aide informs Hirohito that Hiroshima has been attacked with a special bomb from a U.S. bomber. The aide goes on to state that the Navy Ministry, which has been investigating the attacks, believes that most parts of the city have ceased to exist. The aide leaves, allowing Emperor Hirohito to ruminate on what he has just heard. Since the fall of Okinawa 6 weeks ago, he has known that Japan cannot win this war. For a reminder of the Americans' dominance, Hirohito need only look around the Imperial Palace. Despite standing orders by the U.S. military that the Emperor's palace should not be bombed, fires started by B-29 raids on Tokyo have leaped the great stone walls and moats surrounding his fortress and burned Hirohito's wooden residence to the ground. Hirohito and his family now live in the Imperial Library, adjacent to the enormous gardens in which the Emperor now walks. All of the Emperor's official business is conducted in a bunker 60 feet underground. In that way, he is similar to his deceased ally, the German leader Adolf Hitler. Like Hitler, Hirohito has refused to surrender. He has persisted in the belief that the Russians will help him negotiate peace with America. The Emperor still believes that now. However, he is staggered by the news from Hiroshima. If the reports from the city are true, Hirohito knows that only unconditional surrender will save Japan from complete destruction. This will mean the end of the 2,500-year-old imperial dynasty, and perhaps the end of Hirohito's own life, should he be tried and found guilty of war crimes. But 5 hours later, when American President Harry Truman once again demands unconditional surrender from Japan, Hirohito's response is utter silence. While his devastated people suffer and die, the God-man continues his stroll. In Hiroshima, the stench of burned flesh and rotting corpses still hangs over the city as citizens search for missing family members. In scenes played over and over again, the living wander into first aid stations, calling out the names of lost loved ones. They are rarely answered. The surviving soldiers of the Akatsuki Corps lead relief efforts, distributing rice, using wood to burn dead bodies, and arranging transportation out of the shattered city for the living. A light southerly wind blowing across the city wafted to us as an odor suggestive of burning sardines. I wondered what could cause such a smell, until somebody, noticing it too, informed me that sanitation teams were cremating the remains of people who had been killed. The dead were being burned by the hundreds, one survivor will later remember. The mayor of Hiroshima at the time of the blast was a teetotaling Christian named Senkichi Awaya. His official residence was in the city's Kakomachi district, well within the blast zone radius. At the time of the detonation, he was eating breakfast with his son and 3-year-old granddaughter. All three were killed instantly. Awaya's wife, the mother of his 7 children, survived the bombing, only to die 1 month later from radiation poisoning. Footnote: the radioactivity caused by the fission of uranium most severely affected those within 2 miles of the blast center, causing vomiting, diarrhea, hair loss, damage to the bone marrow, which affects the body's ability to produce blood, and large bumps on the skin known as keloids. The lack of white blood cells in victims led to sepsis and infection. Delayed effects included the abnormally high mortality rate among fetuses subjected to high levels of radiation and high levels of mental impairment for those in utero who survived birth. The radiation poisoning was caused not just by the initial blast, but also by the highly radioactive black rain that began falling 20 minutes later. Even those who visited Hiroshima's hypocenter in the weeks after the explosion were subjected to extremely high levels of radiation and began displaying symptoms. Most victims, 90%, of radiation poisoning die within the first 60 days after exposure. Those who live more than 5 months are still subject to a higher rate of cancer mortality than the general population. End footnote. The head of Hiroshima's rationing department is a man named Shinzo Hamai, who will one day become mayor himself. Before the bombing, concerned that the people of Hiroshima would not have food in the event of a major disaster, Hamai arranged that rice balls should be delivered to the city. So it is that villagers in the surrounding countryside make rice balls and deliver them to the hungry survivors in Hiroshima. Within days, the exodus from Hiroshima is complete. More than 150,000 residents travel by military truck or train to temporary shelters. The island of Ninoshima, 5 miles offshore in Hiroshima Bay and untouched by the A-bomb blast, is a storehouse for medical supplies and becomes the region's biggest relief center, providing comfort to more than 10,000 burn victims. The number of wounded quickly overwhelms the available hospital beds, leading many of the burned and maimed to sleep in stables and other enclosures. Bacterial infection stemming from the extreme smoke and debris of the blast runs rampant. Teams of doctors perform surgery around the clock, seeing so many patients that there is no time to clean the operating theater between victims. The most common procedure is amputation. The island facility is not actually a hospital, but a quarantine center that once housed military men and horses returning from duty in foreign lands. There is no provision for the removal of medical waste, so surgeons dispose of severed limbs by throwing them out hospital windows. Piles of arms and legs soon rise higher than the level of the window itself. Yet the amputees are the lucky ones. At least they are alive and can begin planning for a new future. Many victims of the blast who come to Ninoshima seeking medical help die within days from their infections and burns. At first, their corpses are stacked one on top the other for burning. But soon the number of dead bodies is so great that mass cremation becomes impossible. Instead, the dead are carried to air raid shelters and caves, where they are left to rot. These impromptu burial sites will be excavated decades later, uncovering not just bone fragments and ashes, but artifacts like rings and shoes that will help reveal the identities of the dead. This is the new reality in Hiroshima as Emperor Hirohito walks his gardens. Despite the unprecedented carnage, the God-man continues to dither. In Japan, a time of national mourning has begun. At noon on August 15th, as Washington celebrates, Emperor Hirohito's radio address is broadcast to cities, hamlets, and villages throughout the country. Japanese soldiers abroad also hear the message via shortwave radio. The people have never before heard the emperor's voice, so they react with a mixture of curiosity and shock. They are confused, because the poor recording quality and the emperor's use of an archaic form of the Japanese language make him hard to understand. But eventually, the message becomes clear. "To our good and loyal subjects," the emperor starts in his high-pitched voice, "after pondering deeply the general trends of the world and the actual conditions obtaining in our empire today, we have decided to effect a settlement of the present situation by resorting to an extraordinary measure. The war has lasted for nearly 4 years. Despite the best that has been done by everyone, the gallant fighting of the military and naval forces, the diligence and assiduity of our servants of the state, and the devoted service of our 100 million people, the war situation has developed not necessarily to Japan's advantage, while the general trends of the world have all turned against her interest." Hirohito does not use the word surrender. He merely states that his subjects must now pave the way for a grand peace for all the generations to come by enduring the unavoidable and suffering what is unsufferable. To many, that is actually an enormous relief. Their fathers, husbands, and sons might finally return home from the fighting. But other Japanese citizens are shamed and angry. Hirohito wraps up his address with words the Japanese never thought they would hear. "Unite your total strength to be devoted to construction for the future. Cultivate the ways of rectitude, foster nobility of spirit, and work with resolution, so that you may enhance the innate glory of the imperial state and keep pace with the progress of the world." All across Japan, the truth sinks in. Defeat. Many of the emperor's subjects are so stunned at the sound of Hirohito's voice admitting surrender that they collapse to the ground in shock. Several hundred military men disembowel themselves rather than accept Hirohito's capitulation. A group of army and navy officers opt to make their suicides public, kneeling on the gravel in front of the imperial palace before placing pistols to their heads. In some cases, the Japanese response takes the form of rage, as more than a dozen captured American flyers are taken from their POW cells on the island of Kyushu and executed with swords. It is due to war crimes like these that almost as soon as Hirohito's speech is concluded, military bureaucrats across Japan begin burning files and documents that could be used against them by American investigators. And so it is that Japan, the once mighty occupying power, will itself now be occupied. Not even the godman Hirohito can prevent that. Will the Americans seek vengeance? Will the conquerors destroy the Japanese way of life? No one is sure, nor does anyone know how the Japanese will respond to their subjugation. What is apparent is that a new emperor will soon arrive. All hail General Douglas MacArthur. It is May 3, 1946. Formal war crimes indictments are being read at the International Military Tribunal for the Far East in a Tokyo courtroom. These Tokyo trials will see a team of jurists hearing evidence against the accused war criminals. With the exception of Judge Radhabinod Pal of India, who considers the proceedings formalized vengeance sought with arrogance by the Allied powers upon a defeated Japan, the verdicts against the accused will be authoritative. 7 men will be sentenced to death for Class A war crimes, 16 others will be imprisoned for life, and 2 others will be imprisoned for shorter periods of time. Footnote: 25 of the 28 men charged as Class A war criminals in the Tokyo trials were convicted. In addition, Allied prosecutors will hold tribunals against Japanese generals, diplomatic officials, soldiers, and camp guards at several other locations throughout Asia and the Pacific. The British were particularly vigilant in prosecuting those men who killed so many thousands in the construction of the Burma-Siam Railway. In addition to the 25 defendants convicted at the Tokyo trials, another 4,300 Japanese soldiers were found guilty of rape, abuse of POWs, and murder. 1,000 of these men will be sentenced to death. The rest will be given life imprisonment, although many of these sentences will be commuted. End footnote. More than 8 months later, and 20 minutes before midnight in Tokyo's Sugamo prison, Buddhist priest and prison chaplain Shinso Hanayama, the spiritual advisor to the 7 Class A Japanese war criminals who will hang by the neck until dead tonight, shares a last moment with each man in the prison's Buddhist chapel. The date is December 22, 1948. Two American chaplains will witness the executions, but Hanayama will not be allowed inside the death chamber. So as each man leaves the Buddhist ceremony, the priest says goodbye to mass murderers like General Hideki Tojo and former Prime Minister Koki Hirota. A party of 9 witnesses will be on hand to watch the war's final chapter unfold. A total of 20 executioners, guards, jailers, and legal officials will view the hangings. The loved ones of the condemned men have not been invited. Each of the observers in the chamber is under strict instructions not to display unseemly conduct or take photographs. The execution order states that the hangings will take place as soon after midnight on December 23rd as possible. The Sugamo prison execution chamber is so small that there is only one room for 4 nooses, so the war criminals must be hanged in 2 separate shifts. As the clock ticks toward 12, each criminal is clothed in the uniform of an American Army garbageman, devoid of any military insignia. The men's legs are shackled, and waist belts are wrapped around their torsos. Each prisoner will be accompanied to the gallows by 2 American guards. The first group of 4 men is comprised of Generals Kenji Doihara, Iwani Matsui, Akira Muto, and Hideki Tojo. Footnote. General Kenji Doihara is the opium-addicted commander who led the invasion of Manchuria and the subsequent subjugation of the Chinese people. General Iwani Matsui is charged with leading the rape of Nanking. General Akira Muto was responsible for inhumane activities in China, Sumatra, and the Philippines. And Hideki Tojo was the Japanese prime minister responsible for leading Japan into war. End footnote. Leg irons clanking, the column of men is marched to the gallows and up the 13 steps to the platform. The executioner stands at one end. His 3 assistants place a black hood over the head of each condemned man. Nooses are then lowered over the hoods and cinched snugly across their throats. The process will be repeated for the second group to be hanged. General Seishiro Itagaki, Koki Hirota, and General Haitaro Kimura. Footnote. General Seishiro Itagaki was convicted on 8 counts of war crimes, including inhumane treatment of prisoners of war. Former Prime Minister Koki Hirota was in power when Japan invaded China and was sentenced for the attack and subsequent proliferation of the war. General Haitaro Kimura was an assistant to Tojo and also went on to commands throughout Asia. He was charged with allowing the barbaric treatment of Allied POWs to proliferate. End footnote. The hangings take place 29 minutes apart. The Buddhist priest Shinso Hanayama will write that he could hear the trapdoors swing open at 12:01 a.m. and again at 12:30 a.m. Within 90 seconds of climbing the gallows, each man is swinging from a rope. The bodies are then removed and cremated, the ashes dispersed so that no memorial shrine might ever honor the men's lives. In his last words, Tojo, the man responsible for the millions who died in the Pacific during World War II, says he is sorry. The once arrogant and bloodthirsty prime minister is reduced to a broken man. Thus, 2 days before Christmas, the Japanese brutalizers are no more, closing one of the most violent eras the world has ever known. Footnote. Like the bodies of the 6 other men executed on December 23, 1948, Tojo's body was cremated. Despite the best efforts of the Americans, his ashes were split between a Tokyo cemetery and the Yasukuni Shrine, a still controversial memorial to the glorious Japanese war dead. Displays at the nearby Yushukan Military Museum espouse a revisionist history, claiming that the United States was the racist aggressor in the Greater East Asia War, as the Pacific Theater of the Second World War is known in Japan. Shortly before his sentence was carried out, Tojo gave his military ribbons to one of his American jailers. End footnote.